The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I said earlier in my introduction about loving kindness retreat that loving kindness in some ways is very different from the mindfulness practice. And sometimes they don't seem so different. Sometimes they blend together in a very nice way. And a little bit that's the theme of today's talk. And I want to start once again with a Zen story. Yunyan asked Dao Wu, "What does the Bodhisattva of great compassion use so many hands and eyes for?" So Avalokiteshvara or Kuan Yin, and some of the descriptions, the iconic descriptions. I don't know why I pointed there, but sometimes there are. they're sometimes they're on the wall, right? That's a wall, and there's a big picture of sometimes of Spirit Rock. They have one of Kuan Yin with all these different hands, like 1,000 hands, and each hand has a different tool, and also each hand also often has an eye. So what is Avalokiteshvara doing with all these hands and eyes? And the usual answer is that Avalokiteshvara is the Bodhisattva, the great being of compassion, and she has all these hands in order to help people the best. And each hand has a different tool to help in different ways, and all the hands, all the eyes are there to see all the suffering of the world. So the monk asks, "What is the Bodhisattva of great compassion use so many hands and eyes for?" I've read this question other ways. What is it like for Avalokiteshvara to have all these hands and eyes? Wu replied, "It is like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow in the middle of the night." that's a non sequitur. So part of the explanation of that is that when you're kind of a little bit uncomfortable at night, and you're going to kind of bunch up the pillow to make it more comfortable, you're half asleep, and you do it unself-consciously. There's no sense of maybe separation between you and the pillow, or no sense of me, I'm the great pillow buncher-upper. I'm not going to impress anybody with what you're doing with the pillow. You just kind of unself-consciously, just kind of effortlessly, you kind of arrange the pillow. So it's kind of like that Bodhisattva compassion responds to the suffering of the world in that kind of effortless way, unself-conscious way, just kind of what she does, what he does. So the first monk says, "I understand." It's a dangerous thing to say in the Zen world. So Wu said, "How do you understand it?" Yen said, "All over the body are hands and eyes." And Wu said, "You have said quite a bit there, but you've only said 80% of it." These Zen teachers, they like to rate your answers by percentages. I had a teacher in Japan who he asked me a question and he said, "Oh, that's 50%. So they could give grades, I guess. But you only said 80% of it. And Yen said, "Well, what would you say, elder brother?" And Wu said, "Throughout the body are hands and eyes." So the first one said, that the movement of compassion, of care for others, resides throughout the hands and eyes. The sensitivity to that resides all over the body. So it's really an embodied thing. And he said, "That's a good answer, but it's not complete. Because all over the body, because the implication is in the surface of your body, your skin. And the 100% answer is it's throughout your body. There's no, so it's not something you think about. It's not something that's kind of separate from who you are. It's so deeply embedded in who you are that it just comes out from your, from your pores, your muscles, your bones, your marrow, various places. Jennifer Block, who's coming here to do the workshop on Saturday, you might not notice because it's cold and so she probably have socks on, but she has a tattoo on her ankle. It's on her left ankle. And so she hasn't explained to me all the reasons why it's there, but my idea is that when she sits cross-legged in meditation, you can look down, what she sees is the tattoo in her ankle. And the tattoo in her ankle is of a tortoise, a turtle. And the shell of the turtle has the Dharma wheel, the wheel of the Dharma, the symbol for Buddhism. And I love that tattoo of hers because it reminds me of that the tortoise wins the race. You know, slow and steady. So here she is, you know, kind of reminding her. It's a good reminder when you sit down to meditate, not to be in a, you know, to be patient, not to be in a hurry. Take your time. And I think there's something very profound about taking your time and not being in a hurry. And certainly being in a hurry in practice is a syndrome of our time and time, where people are always in a hurry, the most efficient way, getting it over with. We have other things to do, after all. Once the Dalai Lama was asked at a big auditorium about some question around what's the fast way to enlightenment? And I was very touched. I wasn't there, but I heard it. I was very touched by his response. What I was told was that he didn't respond at first. He just stood really, it was really still, quiet for quite a while. So I guess it was kind of poignant, powerful moment. And then I was told that he started crying. And then he said something like, I don't know exactly what he said. I apologize for not knowing and telling the story. But something approximately like, you know, it's to be in a hurry is not really to understand what the Dharma is. And to be to do it quickly, it kind of so much comes along with maybe a self-centered approach to practice, or you know, greedy approach, or something. And there's something very, very significant about taking your time. And I want to tell you another story then that I read in Daniel Goldman's great book called Social Intelligence, his new book. Maybe you know this study, psychological experiment. They took 40 theology students from Princeton Theology Seminary. And they gave them the assignment, going to the library, I guess. And 20 of them had to prepare a very short sermon, like 10-minute sermon, on a random passage from the Bible. Another 20 of them had to do a 10-minute sermon on the story of the Good Samaritan. And the Good Samaritan is a story in the Bible where this person is distressed or injured or sick or something on the road, and I guess most people pass the person by, but the Good Samaritan stops and aids the person. So, and unbeknownst to the students, they were part of an experiment. They just thought it was the assignment for a class, I guess. And then at 15-minute intervals, they were sent out of the library across campus someplace where they were supposed to give the little talk to some teachers or someone who was going to. And on their way there, in a doorway, was a man in distress, an actor in distress, laying in the doorway, sick and groaning and all that. And the experiment really was to see, would they stop? And would the ones who did the talk on the Good Samaritan, would those students stop more than the students who were just doing a random passage from the Bible? And they found that 24 students stopped out of 40. But there was no difference between the ones who did the Good Samaritan and the ones who did the random passage. So that's interesting in itself. But they did find, and I guess they did experiments in different ways as well, they did find that one thing made a big difference. The students who were told they were late and they had to hurry to get to the give their talk, of those 10 students, only one of them stopped. Of those students who said were told, "Oh, you have lots of time to get over there. Take your time, whatever." 6 of them stopped. So the ones who took the time, the ones who had felt they had time, they're more likely to respond from care, compassion. Those who felt they were in a hurry were caught up. You know, maybe they're preoccupied, they're in a hurry, they're not paying attention, they have important things to do. There's a variety of reasons why they might not be paying attention or offer their attention or stopping to care. And then Daniel Goldman, after talking about this in his book, he says that he had the experience in New York City coming out of a subway. And there was a man, shirtless, laying flat on the ground, out, apparently, face down. And the crowds of people just stepping over him. And so he stopped. But as soon as he stopped, then lots of other people stopped. And then people started helping. Lots of people started helping. But he felt that it was his attention, stopping and giving attention, that then became the magnet for other people's attention to pay attention. Otherwise, people's attention weren't going there for a variety of reasons. They're busy, they're preoccupied, they're afraid. Who knows what it means? I once stopped for someone in San Francisco. I was 18, I think. And I was kind of visiting San Francisco by myself and up in Chinatown area. And this guy was out, more or less out, on the kind of half in the gutter or something, on the side of the gutter on the sidewalk. And so I stopped to go over and try to take care of him. And because I'd never seen anything like that before. And I said, "Can I help you with something?" He said, "Come closer. Come closer." So I got closer. "Can I help you in any way?" "Come closer." So I got really close to him. And then he said to me, "Kiss me." So maybe now I would kiss him, but when I was 18, that quite didn't quite compute, and I didn't quite know what to do at that point, so I got up and left. You know, maybe I'd do something differently now, but so you never know what you get. But so, but this idea of our attention, I think, is a really important thing here. That there's a correlation between having time and our attention, and how well we pay attention to things, and how well we let things register. If we have the time, if we don't give ourselves the time, then things don't sink in. We don't digest them. They don't get processed in our psyche. We don't understand the depth of it, of what's really happening to us. And I think it's so easy in our life, for many people in these lives we have, to live undigested lives because we're so busy, we're always doing. And part of the function of meditation is to help digest what's going on, so we process what's happening. But I think also, more importantly, it's also to help us pay attention in a deeper way, a more full way, to really take in what's happening. And as we take in more fully, we also then, it's not just taking in and paying attention. There's two sides to this. There's one is the paying attention, noticing what's there, but it's also having a chance for deeper places of motivation, deeper places of motivation to arise out of us and respond to what we see out there. I think it's very easy when we're busy to respond even from unkind places. Probably all of you can identify with at least the imaginary situation of being late for some very important things, and been a day of being harried and frustrated, and you're trying to get to this place, and there's a lot of traffic on the freeway, and it's smoggy, and it's hot, your air conditioner doesn't work, and just like you have a headache. I can go on, right? But I should spare you. And then you're on the freeway, and someone cuts you off, and it's very easy for people to do something then for you to do something with your finger that you would never do if you were calm and relaxed and centered. But somehow, when you're caught up in your anxiety and frustration, we don't necessarily respond from the places that we'd respond to if we're relaxed and settled deeply in ourselves. And our suggestion is that when we're settled deeply in ourselves, that we respond from beautiful places, where we tend to, at least. So again, to borrow from Daniel Goldman's book, he tells a story of an experiment done with monkeys, rhesus monkeys. How do you pronounce it? Rhesus? And apparently they took six monkeys and they trained them that they can get the most amount of food from their particular... Each one had their own particular cord they pulled. And they get the most amount of food was delivered if they pulled their cord. And so they trained. So they got pretty good at that. They pulled the cord and they got lots of food. And then they introduced a seven monkey. And the seven monkey also had a cord. But when that monkey pulled the cord, No. When any of them pulled their cord, the seventh monkey got an electrical shock. And very quickly, the monkeys would stop using their cord to prevent the other monkey from getting shocked. And one monkey stopped eating for 6 days, another 12 days, because of the connection to the other monkey. So the suggestion is that, and the title of the thing that I read was called something like, we're hardwired for compassion. You know, it's kind of like, you know, kind of deeply ingrained. It's not just software that we add. It's something there. But I think it's there when we are settled and relaxed. So we allow these things to have a chance to come forth rather than, you know, other things. And that's certainly been my experience in my years of practice. I did not come to Buddhism with any interest in compassion or with loving kindness, two central kind of motivations and responses to the world in Buddhist practice. And those things kind of snuck up on me. And the compassion was awakened for me through my Zen practice. Not necessarily inherent to Zen practice, but that just happened to be what I did first. And I think my practice while I was doing the Zen period was in many ways very painful. A lot of suffering, a lot of struggles and difficulties. And as I sat with all that, I sat a lot. You know, sit every day. We sit hours, sometimes in the monastery, you know, days and days and sitting. So in terms of having time, there was a lot of time. So this stuff was able to process, to digest. And one of the things that happened was that as I sat with all that, some of my armor, my resistance, my fear, my started to soften and fall away. And I got to sit with the struggles of my own struggles, also other people's pain. I got to become very sensitive to other people's suffering. I got to sit to it with this very soft heart. And in that soft heart, the response was compassion. It wasn't like I was trying to be compassionate or even thought it was a good idea. I just noticed that after a while that was more and more became who I was or what the response was. And I thought of it as not as a choice, but more of who I became or who I was. Some people would say it's non-dualistic. It's like not out of my sense of self or out of choice. It's not like a person's out there and I'm the one here who's supposed to be compassionate. It just kind of seemed to be kind of a natural response. In fact, I told one of my teachers that I felt I was becoming a response machine. And now that's not a very pretty analogy, a machine. But what I was groping with was trying to explain how it wasn't me doing it. It was just kind of natural, innate kind of thing moving through me and to respond. And then when I started doing, but after I did Vipassana practice for a period of time, when I was doing Vipassana practice, in that phase of my practice, you know, again, it's not inherent in Zen or Vipassana, it has to do with where people are at in their life. But in that particular phase of my practice, I sat with a lot of, I didn't sit with a lot of suffering anymore. That phase of my practice had been worked through in some ways. And I sat now with a lot of delight and joy and ease or peace, a strong sense of well-being. And I remember when I was first introduced to loving kindness meditation by my teachers, and I tuned them out. And I came from the Zen background. It's, you know, it's this love stuff. It's artificial. It's sentimental. And I wasn't going to, you know, try to evoke it through this practice, you know, when it wasn't there naturally. That just, you know, I was still a Zenny, you know, right to the heart of things. So I just tuned my teachers out. And I ignored that part of the practice until, as I kept doing the Vipassana practice, again, there's this the time, the subtleness, and the falling away of, again, the armor, the barriers, the resistance, the sense of self, the self-identity that kind of stayed between me and the open heart, all fell away. And then, lo and behold, in the midst of all this mindfulness practice, there bubbled up this tremendous feeling of loving kindness. And I was just kind of amazed. And then when the teacher started talking about loving kindness practice, it made sense to me. And now I love it. Now I think it's a great practice. But it kind of came out of that quiet and that sensitivity and that kind of openness that took a lot of, for me, in my situation, took a lot of time in order for that to happen. So, I don't know if this is, you know, so imagine, you know, here's an analogy. There's a town that is really afraid of the threats. Maybe there are real world threats out there. The Huns are invading. And so the townspeople wall off the city, make a walled city. And they do a really good job in walling off the city. And they're really safe. And the marauding masses can't get in. And it's really safe in that town. They feel good and safe and comfortable. And they've done such a good job walling off the city, they even forgot to make a door, a gate, just the wall. And after a while, the marauding invaders leave. And it becomes safe to leave the walled city. But they forgot to make a gate. And so they don't know how to get out. So what do they have to do? The first thing they're going to have to do is focus on that wall and do something about that wall, you know, because there's no gate. So maybe they take hammers and chisels and whatever they have available to themselves and start working on that wall until it kind of comes crumbling down. And then they could step over the crumbled walls and walk out into the world. So I think to some degree, you know, that often happens to us, that the world, we feel the world's a threatening place. And a lot of things get built up that prevent us from having an open, clear channel between our heart and the people in the world experiences around us. And so to the degree which that happens, it's important to look at that barrier, what that is all about. And for sometimes it's certainly fear. Maybe there has been real threats, real danger, real problems that happen in the world to you and that we close up. Sometimes there's imagined threats the world provides. And so we're reacting to that. Sometimes it's not so much the threats of the world, but it's all the ways in which we build up tension and stress in our muscles. And so the muscles get tight. And so all that tension keeps us from really kind of connecting to what's deeper below that muscular level. And then so at some point we realize that it's safe enough to open up. And there's two reasons I can imagine someone feeling that it's safe. One is that the invaders have gone, so that it's safe out there. And the other is that the threats out there are not gone, but they have enough confidence in themselves that they don't have to worry about going out and facing the invaders, facing the threat. And I think both are very important. It's not one or the other. And as we get older, certainly, I think many of us develop the skills, the street smarts, the wisdom, the maturity, to be able to go into situations that in the past were threatening to us, but are no longer threatening. So it's not just a matter of dealing, you know, the threats out there changing, but it's also a matter of us changing as well. But one way or the other, at some point we feel it's okay to lower our guard, to drop this. And so a big part of practice for many people, especially initially, is not about focusing on the world out there, but it's about focusing here. In a sense, you can colloquially say focus on oneself. But that sense of focusing on oneself is very interesting because as the armor, the barriers, the resistance, the walls, the tension falls away, one of the things that has to fall away is a strong sense of self in the sense of egotistical self or self-centered self or a kind of tight, narrow sense of self. And that has to fall away as well. And so if we're doing a practice in a self-absorbed way, neurotic kind of way, that will naturally fall away. And then this wonderful thing happens when the walls fall down, then the people can go out and you can really feel a connection to the world. You can feel it's kind of like this magic thing where you kind of go in for a while. And if you go in far enough, it's like, you know, going through the looking glass. Alice goes through the looking glass. You go into the looking glass, you go into here, and then you come out there. Because, you know, that sense of separation falls away. So there's this kind of focusing. And so we focus here first. And I think to a large degree, whether we focus on it directly or indirectly, this centering ourselves, being with our breath, being present, giving ourselves time to be present, being giving ourselves time where we're not getting more input all the time, or giving us time where we're not always doing and acting and reacting and responding, allows things to begin to settle, fall away. It's kind of like a vacation, allows things to settle away. But hopefully meditation is deeper than a vacation, because if you go do enough meditation, it allows things to go fall away, drop away, relax in a deeper and deeper place. And then as we drop all the extra stuff, then this real beauty that's within us gets a chance to have a chance to come out in the sun. It gets a chance to respond, react, feel, sense the world we live in. And the idea here is that there's all this beauty there. And I would say compassion is beautiful, loving kindness is beautiful, and those things are there waiting for us if we can do the work of settling all this stuff. It's a kind of a natural thing to be there. It's throughout the body. So last thing I want to say is I want to teach you about a distinction that the Buddha made that I think is important in the early Buddhist tradition. And first I'll teach you the Pali word. The word is Amisa. A-M-I-S-A. Amisa. And the word means flesh or raw meat. And the word sa means with. Sa-misa means with flesh. And near means without. So near Amisa means without flesh. And this distinction is used for two kinds of feelings that people can have. There's feelings that we can have that are of the flesh, and feelings we can have that are not of the flesh. It's a little bit hard, I think, with our kind of English and cultural understandings to get a complete sense of what the Buddha was talking about. But it's like this, that of the flesh are those experiences, those feelings, pleasure, pain, variety of things that can come, that are experienced through our five senses. Smell, sounds, tastes, tactile. So when it's through the five senses, then it's of the flesh, in this ancient way of talking. And then there's a whole series of things, of feelings, pleasant, unpleasant feelings we can have, that are not born of the flesh, but are not of the flesh, not of the skin or the muscles. So when the muscles muscles relax enough, when we're not centered enough, then these other feelings begin bubbling up. And this is something that happens a lot in meditation. When you get somewhat focused and centered on yourself in meditation, a sense of well-being begins to bubble up. And that well-being that bubbles up from the inside out is not being stimulated by a sense object. No one's coming along and massaging you or stroking you, or you're not having this wonderful sound or something. And so it's not of this five senses, but it's this non-sensory, in a sense, feelings that arise. And in this way, the Buddha distinguished between this sensory and non-sensory feelings. The sensory feelings he called domestic. and the non-sensory he called renunciant. And you have to, hopefully you're generous with these distinctions with the Buddha, with these distinctions. So you don't kind of say, wait a minute, my domestic life is great. But if you understand the household life or the domestic life to be one with a lot of activity, a lot of doing and, you know, fixing and doing this and that, you should come to my house. It's taken me 6 months, I think, I often have to figure out how to get the kids to school by myself in the morning, two kids. It took me about 6 months to learn how to do that without feeling frazzled. Because it's pretty complicated. You want to make sure they sleep as long as possible. But you don't want to just stay. If they sleep too long, then you have too large of a window to get them dressed and fed. But then also you have to take into account the fact that a 5-year-old is not always so reasonable. you know, doesn't want to get dressed, doesn't, you know, this and that, you know, and just even getting the shoes on sometimes can take a while. And then there's my meditation I like to do in the morning, and I like to have a little bit of quiet time to read the paper as well. And so there's a lot that had to be fit into the into that before I got the kids out of the door at 10 to 8 and to wherever they had to go to school and stuff. It took me 6 months before I felt some mastery of that. And I felt a fair amount of stress around this domestic issue, especially the last 10 minutes. And so the domestic world, the renunciant world, you know, is the world not necessarily where you leave the domestic life, but it's those pleasures, those feelings that arise when we're not caught up, preoccupied in all the things of the world. Now, I know plenty of monastics who are caught up in the domestic life of the monastery in the same way as people are in domestic life. So it's not a hard and fast distinction here. But the distinction is being caught up and preoccupied with things and activities versus those things that come out of us when we're not preoccupied and caught up. So one of the instructions for cultivating loving kindness practice is you don't want to be too busy. To have too many projects, it's hard to let loving kindness practice develop. So what is it that what is beautiful in your life that can arise and be there most effectively, most helpfully for others when you give yourself lots of time? And so I like to think of the Sabbath as creating sacred leisure. Leisure is maybe not the right word, best word, but the idea of leisure, free time, of empty time, that's sacred, that allows something else to happen that can't happen when we fill every possible minute, when we're efficient. So I'd encourage you all to be inefficient and take your time and remember that the tortoise will win the race. Lily Tomlin said, if you win the rat race, you're still a rat. So in that spirit, I should end early. So we have 5 whole minutes to take our time, set up for the potluck, hang out with each other, say hello, and so we don't feel rushed by anything. So thank you very much.